From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Voting rights are under the spotlight yet again. The U.S. Supreme Court is reviewing a process known as preclearance under the Voting Rights Act. It is a measure designed to protect against discrimination at the polling booth. But a Seward district of 3,500 people in Texas has questioned the fairness of the procedure, saying preclearance gives the federal government too much say in state affairs. To explain more, I am joined now by Kalila Brown Dean. She is a professor of political science at Yale University. Professor, welcome to News and Notes.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
This complaint by the Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District Number 1 relates to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It was created in 1965, and its relevance today is at issue now. What does Section 5 do, and why is it so important to the Voting Rights Act?
Section 5 simply requires certain jurisdictions to gain federal consent before they can make any changes to their election laws or procedures. So the jurisdiction has to prove that the law will not have a discriminatory purpose, but it also cannot have a discriminatory effect. And so this is what's key about Section 5, is that it says, yes, we may be beyond the strictly racist intent of past laws, but if it discriminates against certain groups, that law can still be invalidated.
Now, this act, this key part of the act, has been extended several times over the years, and it was last extended in 2006 by Congress. My question is, why is it now that it is going to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think there are two reasons. First is, quite simply, now that we have elected the country's first African-American president, critics are saying we no longer need Section 5. We no longer need these protections to ensure that voters are not being discriminated against. And while I think it's incredibly premature to make that argument based on one election, that is really driving this case. The second issue at hand is that the players in this game have changed and elevated to higher office. So when John Roberts worked in the Reagan administration, Roberts, who is now Chief Justice of the court, he worked to weaken Section 5. He argued that if black voters cannot prove a discriminatory intent, they should not be allowed to file voter discrimination claims. So now that Roberts is Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, that will have an effect. Now that Eric Holder has become Attorney General and the Department of Justice is really charged with investigating these claims, that will have an impact on how serious the case is evaluated, but also some of the potential consequences.
Now, one of the things that's been said about this particular case, and you've made reference to it, is that the issue centers around what is in legal circles is known as congruence and proportionality. In other words, whether or not the punishment fits the crime, so to speak, if I can make that analogy. My question, though, is why this particular small Seward district in Texas would be the place where opponents of the extension would choose to fight this.
I think that it's a way of getting away from some of the claims that groups that would push for this type of reform or for changing Section 5 are being discriminatory, that they simply do not want certain groups to have the same rights and privileges as others. This is a way of escaping that critique, but it is also a way of local government saying we have to bear the burden of meeting these requirements, whether it's through the distribution of resources to make sure that we're filing the claims with the Department of Justice, having to make special provisions in order to do so. And so they're saying that they should not have to shoulder that burden. I think it's a more effective argument for a local government to make or for a smaller jurisdiction or municipality to make. But it also, again, lets us know about the importance of federalism and deciding to what extent should the federal government have oversight and making sure that every citizen has access to voting.
Is racial makeup an issue in this particular district?
I think racial and ethnic makeup is an important component, and it's something that is significant about the VRA and about Section 5. Although it originally was intended to enhance African Americans' access to voting, over time, it's helped millions of citizens, Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans, come into the political process and be able to enjoy the same rights and benefits of citizenship as others. And so the makeup in that particular jurisdiction is different, but certainly is in line with the spirit of the Voting Rights Act.
Professor Brown Dean, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Kalila Brown Dean. She is a professor of political science Science at Yale University, and we continue this conversation now with Chris Ward. He is one of the lead counsel representing Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District Number 1. It launched the proceedings back in 2006. We are also joined by Debo Adegbole. He is the director of litigation at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, one of the organizations working to keep the Voting Rights Act in its current form. Mr. Ward, Mr. Adegbole, welcome.
Hi, Tony.
Mr. Ward, let me begin with you. Let's talk about why your client decided to bring this case at this particular time.
Well, you've touched on this earlier, Tony. The utility district has no history of voting discrimination. It was formed in the late 1980s. It's a small neighborhood of diverse residents. Most of them get along, as neighbors do. No one's ever identified a single complaint about the district's elections. And the first thing this lawsuit actually asked for is a ruling that this little district doesn't need federal oversight. We're first trying to take advantage of a process called bailout. Now, this is not to be confused with the financial bailouts in the news right now. The Section 5 bailout is supposed to let jurisdictions with a good history, like our district, simply get out of Section 5 coverage.
Now, let me ask you a question before I bring in Mr. Adegbole. Whether or not this is partisan in any way, and I ask that because you were described in an article in the New York Times, and I'm quoting here, as a well-connected Texas Republican lawyer representing what is surely one of the most obscure jurisdictions to be covered by Section 5.
Well, I'm not sure how connected I am, but I would say this is something that's not really partisan in nature. One reason it's not is that Section 5 has actually been used to distort the redistricting process in some ways. Now, this doesn't affect our utility district as much, but in other contexts, and in some ways, Republicans like what Section 5 does to districting. One example, after the 2000 census in Georgia, the Democratic-controlled legislature, with the support of a majority of the African-American members of that body, wanted to put in place a redistricting plan that part of the objective was partisan, to shore up Democratic support in the legislature. But one of the ways it did that was to unpack these heavily concentrated African-American majority districts to spread the influence of African-American voters throughout more districts.
Well, let me bring in Mr. Adegbole to address some of what you are speaking of. First of all, Mr. Adegbole, in terms of this key issue in terms of Section 5, your support of it is based, your continuing support of it is based on what?
My continuing support of it and that of the Legal Defense Fund is based on the extensive record that Congress established when it decided to reauthorize the provision in 2006. There were two key things that Congress found after 10 months of hearings and over 16,000 pages of testimony of various kinds from supporters and opponents. And the two key findings of Congress were that the country has made a tremendous amount of progress in the area of voting and racial equality in voting, and that lots of that progress was attributable to the existence of the Voting Rights Act. But the second finding was that the progress was incomplete, and that if the promises of the Constitution are to be taken seriously, we have further to go before minority communities are fully included in the political process.
If there are no instances of voter irregularity in this particular section, are there conditions under which you could see states being allowed to be removed from preclearance? And is this not an example of one of them, potentially?
I could definitely foresee circumstances in which states could be removed from preclearance, and indeed Congress also believes that there are circumstances under which jurisdictions can be removed from preclearance. Congress set the bar for the level at which jurisdictions can make that application, and the municipal utility district falls below that bar. So this was a congressional decision about what the most efficient way for the statute to exist is. and little utility districts were not at the level that Congress wanted districts to be applying to escape from coverage under the Voting Rights Act.
What about that, Mr. Ward? Let me ask Mr. Ward that only because our time is running very short. Mr. Ward, what about that?
First of all, we read the statute a little bit differently. We think we are entitled to take advantage of this bailout process, but that's part of the problem is the way bailout's been interpreted by the Department of Justice. It's like a Hotel California, that old Eagles song where you can check out but you can never leave. So it hasn't been allowed to operate to release districts from these conditions. Dabo also, he talked about the findings in 2006. One very important thing, though, is the coverage of Section 5 as of 2006 is still based on 1972 data or earlier. It goes back to statistics from the 1972 presidential election and says basically these jurisdictions that were having problems, 35 or more years ago are still the ones we're going to cover today.
I'm going to have to stop you there only because our time has run out. I know these are arguments that you will both be making before the United States Supreme Court. Chris Ward, representing Northwest Austin Municipal Utility District, and Dabo Adegbole, representing the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. This week on our Africa Update, Somalia's new president enters the country for the first time since his exile, but will he be able to get insurgents and pirates under control? And Rwanda hands over a Congolese war criminal. For more now, we've got Amira Wood. She is co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Hi, Amira.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
It's fine. Thank you very much. We've got a lot to talk about, so let's jump right to it. Somalia recently welcomed their new president, Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed. He has just returned to Somalia for the first time since his exile, but his reception, as I understand it, wasn't exactly welcoming all the way around. There were mortar shells at the presidential palace, weren't there?
Well, so this is the thing, Tony. There's a sense among Somalis that yet again you have had a leader picked outside the country and coming into Mogadishu to be welcomed, and people are still not happy, not being able to get their political will actually reflect it in the leadership that's selected for the government. So there is a sense that, yes, it is good that the Ethiopian forces are leaving and the occupation of Somalia is ending, as many have seen it. But there is also a sense that the governance is still not right, that the will of the people is still not being reflected in this new governing body. So I think there is a frustration that's reflected in those mortar attacks, right? So luckily,
yeah,
No one was injured, but it is a sense that things are still not quite right, that you have had over 20 years without a government and that this government is still not seen as legitimate enough in the eyes of many Somalis.
You mentioned the Ethiopian troops, and yet you talked about them leaving, but they're still there as well, aren't they? I guess they're leaving and staying at the same time, if that's possible to do. What does that depict for the country?
Well, it's still, it's occupation that's ending in a very slow and drawn out way. But it's a sense that the Ethiopians and quite frankly, the Americans who are backing the Ethiopians are still very much calling the shots. And Somalis want to be able to control their own destiny. That's the core of the issue here, that there's a sense that Somalis have not been able to control their own destiny for way too long. And what many throughout the country are calling for is a sense of real return to political governance that reflects the will of the people, that is selected by the people, not by outsiders, but by the Somalis themselves, and that is able to then put both the economy that is really devastated now with this global economic crisis and a food crisis on top of that, and put a political system in place that works for the Somali people.
One more thing about Somalia before we move on. The pirates there who hijacked that Ukrainian ship loaded with weapons have finally left the vessel. 5 months, a standoff there. $3 million was paid in ransom. The new Somali president, what's he going to be able to do about that, if anything?
Well, I think there is some sense that those pirates, you know, were answerable to no one, but that they could be answerable to a government of the Somali people that selected and given a sense of, you know, real legitimacy by the Somali people. I think the key issue here is what will the other countries do? Let's remember now, this ship was able to continue on its voyage. It's a ship that contains a cache of arms, of weapons going to potentially Sudan by way of Kenya. And what happened? It was the American Navy, the U.S. Navy, that is now escorting this ship on its way with arms to fuel further crises in the Horn of Africa. So we have to look beyond the role of the pirates and really look at the role of the international community in terms of why is this cache of arms being allowed to not only to leave Somalia, but to reach its final destination there in the Horn of Africa? And to what extent will that fuel even further deaths there in the Horn of Africa, whether it's in South Sudan or elsewhere in Sudan? These are the questions that are broader questions that have been raised by this freeing, quote unquote, of this ship containing such a large cache of weapons headed for the Horn of Africa.
Let's move on to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where Rwandan troops take up positions across the eastern part of the country. This time, though, they've done it by invitation. I want to talk also about Laurent Nkunda, but first, let's talk about these troops. They were asked by the Congolese government to flush out Hutu militias, right?
Well, so the core here is in the absolutely all over the eastern Congo, the issue is around control of resources that are vital to the global economy. Without the coltan that comes from the eastern Congo, we cannot have cell phones, we cannot have computers. And so these battles have gone on really over control of these vital mining areas where these resources lie. And I think what is critical is that, you know, the UN in its report that was released in December 08 essentially nailed it by saying that the borders across the border, Rwanda, played a critical role in fueling the crisis in the eastern Congo. And now you have had pressure then put on Rwanda to actually come up with and to play a role in helping to bring about the peace. So this is an incredible movement forward that, you know, Nkunda is actually put forward by the Rwandan government. I think it is a step in the right direction, a step that many of the Congolese have been calling for quite some time.
So you think he will actually face war crime charges?
I think there is a lot on the plate of the International Criminal Court right now. When you look at especially Bashir from Sudan, who has also been indicted, and when you look at Nkunda as well, I think there is a lot on the plate of the International Criminal Court. But this clearly should be one case that they pursue, and they pursue in a speedy and efficient manner.
Let's end our Africa update this week with this really briefly. On to North Africa, Madagascar. The defense minister resigned on Monday in protest of a police shooting of opposition leaders. What's going on there, really briefly?
Well, essentially, it is people in Madagascar that are fed up with a government that isn't serving their needs. And so you had a peaceful protest. Thousands of Madagascarans that were actually organizing peacefully to demonstrate. First, they were demonstrating on issues of corruption and more importantly, on issues of governance and lack of responsible governance and a sense that the government had really become dictatorial and entrenched their power in ways that didn't serve the interests of the people. So these peaceful protests then ended up with the army essentially opening fire and you know, killing innocent civilians. There were at least 29 to 30 people who were killed, and some say there were thousands who were injured, but at least 200 were reported wounded officially in the wounded category. Oh. And I think overall you had a sense of things gone awry.
I have to cut you off there, Mira, only because our time ran out. I wanted to also correct that we put Madagascar in the north when it should have been in the south. Amira right. Woods, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Singer-songwriter Asha was born in Paris but spent her childhood in Lagos, Nigeria. She returned to Paris as an adult to test her talent on the French music scene, but it was in Nigeria where Asha first discovered the sounds that would influence the music she creates. She joined us recently to talk about her debut album. It's a mix of reggae, soul, and jazz with a touch of pop. I started our interview by asking Asha about the catalyst for her music career, her father's eclectic record collection.
Wonderful is what you are to me.
My father had, you know, good collections of music from Marvin Gaye, Fela Kuti to Bob Marley. He had it all. And he was a cameraman, and he used the music to do something special with the pictures. So, you know, while he's playing, I would sneak around and just listen. So I think music started for me then.
Were you ever in a situation, Asha, where you were torn between, because you mentioned your dad had Motown and Marvin Gaye, mm-hmm. torn between the American urban music and the more traditional music of Nigeria and in Africa?
That was the sin, you know. It was between American, the West, you know, influence, and then the church music and the street music, traditional music from Nigeria.
Now, let me make sure I heard you clearly. Did you say that it was a sin, or that's what was in?
That was what was in.
Okay, it was not a sin to,
no.
to perform that kind of music. But at the beginning, that's what you were drawn to?
Yes.
And at some point, you were like, I want to do what?
I wanted to get in touch with my identity, my roots. Yoruba is my language. That's what I, you know, that's my mother's song. And I started to embrace it.
At some point, it became clear to you that you really did have a future as a performer, as a singer, as a songwriter. What was it and when was it that you knew, you know, this is, I'm good at this. I've got a future here.
When I was a little girl, I was really sure of what I wanted.
That you were going to be something. Well,
yes.
When did you learn to play the guitar?
I was 20, 21, when I got the chance to buy me a guitar, and it was a revenge. People frowned at, you know, about me doing music, and after school, I grew up with my, I was living with my grandparents, and it was a Muslim home, and, you know, things are pretty much quiet there, so I didn't have that freedom to express, so I was always frustrated. So one day I got tired. The money that was supposed to be for school fees, I just took it and went out and bought me a guitar. And that was a revenge, actually.
Now, you've been performing for some time, and I know that you have recorded before, but this Asha is still considered your debut CD, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's wonderful, first of all.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it. The very first cut on here is a very intriguing track. It's called Jailer.
Yeah.
And some of the lyrics say, Jailer, I am in chains, you're in chains too. I wear uniforms, you wear uniforms too. I'm a prisoner, you're a prisoner too, Mr. Jailer. Where did that come from?
The main reason why the song was written was, in Nigeria, we've had, you know, a lot of dictators. People have suffered so much. And I think the country is just picking up from this horrible experiences we've had.
Well, you know, one of the things about your CD and your music, it's been described many different ways. One of the ways that it has been described is as music that has a message, and certainly Jailer is a song that does that. Here's what caught me by surprise, Asha, and that's that you make interesting points in your lyrics, and yet the music is so soft and sweet that it doesn't seem angry at all. And you have to listen carefully to really pay attention to what you're saying, because if you're just listening to the melody, it takes you to a different place. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. That was done on purpose.
Was it?
Yes. But honestly, I sat down and said, okay, I will sing a sad song, but in a happy way. I know pain. There are different categories of pain.
Yes,
but,
there are.
And I don't want to put too much pain out there. You know, it's better. I try to put, you know, hope and positivity, which I think is the solution. You know, we are all praying for hope, and we have to be positive to achieve this. So I try to put that in the music.
There is fire on the mountain, and nobody seems to be on the run. Oh, there is fire on the mountain top, and no one is running. I wake up in the morning, tell you what I see on my TV screen. I see the blood of an innocent child, and everybody's watching.
Talk about the song Fire in the Mountain. This is another example of social justice lyrics, isn't it?
Yes. Fire in the Mountain has talked about a lot of things that we all know, we all familiarize with, from war to pedophile to diamond blood, you know, to many things, many more, you know. Really, what I'm talking about there is I'm trying to make us aware of what we already know, but we are scared to talk about or to approach.
What do you want as this new CD is being introduced to America?
What do I want? First, I want people to discover my music, to also discover where I come from. I like to talk about Africa as a beautiful place with beautiful people, kind-hearted people, and also Africans themselves. You know, we need to start looking at ourselves differently. We're not very confident. You know, if you go back home, people are, you know, they're down because things are not working. I want to heal with my music, not only Africans, but everybody, you know, across the world.
Congratulations on this. Would you play something for us?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
All right.
I'm in chains, you're in chains too. I wear uniforms and you wear uniforms too. I'm a prisoner, you're a prisoner too, Mr. Jailer. I have fears, you are fierce too. I would die, but yourself could die too. Life is beautiful, don't you think so too, Mr. Jailer? I'm talking to you, Jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let hear you is without Saint Peter first to cast a stone, Mr. Jailer. Hey, Mr. Jailer.
That was singer-songwriter Asha. Her album, Asha, was released earlier this year. She joined us here at the studios of NPR West.
Part of me, what you don't know, you're a victim too, Mr. Jailer. You don't care.
Next on News and Notes, way before Oprah, there was Hazel Scott, the first woman of color to host her own TV show. We'll hear her amazing story. And songstress Shantae Moore shares her soul and a painful past.
Mr. Jailer, I'm talking to you, Jailer. Stop calling me a prisoner. Let hear you is without seeing me the first to cast a stone, Mr. Jailer. Hey, Mr. Jailer, if you walk in the marketplace, don't throw stones, even if you don't.
You're listening to News and Notes from NPR News.
Hello, fellas. This is Hazel Scott. Cindy Catlett, the drums. We'd like to do a little jump number for you. Sea Jam Blues.
Hazel Scott, a classically trained jazz pianist and singer who became the first African-American woman to have her own show, but whose outspoken nature may have cost her her rightful place in history. Well, for anyone asking who is Hazel Scott, a new book about her life has all the answers. It's called Hazel Scott, The Pioneering Journey of a Jazz Pianist from Cafe Society to Hollywood to the House Un-American Activities Committee. Karen Chilton is the author, and we're also joined now by Hazel Scott's son, Adam Clayton Powell III. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
This is a great project. Karen, let me talk to you first about why you did it and how long. I understood it took a little while to get it done.
Well, initially, when I set out, I was interested in writing a book on black women artist expatriates, and that's what I was researching at the time. And I actually stumbled across Hazel Scott. I didn't know much about her. And growing up on the south side of Chicago, I was sort of raised in jazz and blues, so I considered myself, you know, an expert on jazz. And I was actually very frustrated by the fact that I had never heard of Hazel Scott. I stumbled across her photo in a book in the New York Public Library. I thought, well, who is she? Then I found another obscure out-of-print book. I think it was from the 60s. And it was a book about expatriates, and it was sort of a Q&A style book. And I started reading Hazel's essays, you know, or the answers to the questions that were posed to her. And I was really compelled to dig a little deeper. And before I knew it, I had shelved the other project, and I was just fully, you know, engulfed in the Hazel Scott world. And I thought, well, surely there's a book on her. Went to the bookstore, and there was nothing. And the more I learned about her, I found it really hard to believe that there had been nothing written on such a fascinating artist.
Let me ask you, Adam, why is that the case?
I think that it may be because the peak of her fame as a musician, as an entertainer, was in the 40s and 50s. And between having her career cut off in Hollywood in the mid-40s, and then being blacklisted in the early 50s, the blacklist did work.
Now, to be married to Adam Clayton Powell Jr. as she was, that would make for an interesting story in and of itself, Karen.
Yes.
But to have the experience that she had both musically and politically, particularly as it relates to the House Un-American Activities Committee, that put it on another plane altogether, didn't it?
It certainly did, and I think that her being blacklisted, you know, it created this other whole trail of events, because right after her trial, her TV show was canceled, and a lot of people don't know that she was one of the first black women to host her own television show.
She was the first.
The first. Her show, The Hazel Scott Show, aired in July of 1950. Her trial before HUAC was September of 1950, and then was subsequently canceled after her appearance. Then also, you know, booking started to dry up in the States. The marriage was falling apart at that point as well. And then she became an expatriate in Paris.
She went before HUAC of her own accord. She wasn't subpoenaed. She volunteered, wanted to go. And that seems to be the defining moment of her life, because it affected the family, it affected her career, it affected everything, didn't it?
And I remember as I must have been 5 years old at the time, my mother and father and I used to eat dinner together, and they were having a spirited discussion, not an argument, because my father thought she was absolutely out of her mind to go before the committee. He said, you can't win. No one wins by going before HUAC. And she said, but I want to go and clear my name, and who are you to say that I shouldn't do something which is right? This is as he was getting into all kinds of political trouble for the Powell Amendment and other things, early civil rights legislation that he was writing. So yes, it was a defining moment, but a moment which was not taken lightly, and certainly she wasn't unaware of what could happen.
Now I want to go back a little farther in terms of what made her become the kind of person that she was. Knowing that she was Trinidadian and that her father was part African, and she claimed a number of ethnic roots all jumbled up in there together. But there were two or three things that occurred in her lifetime that are mentioned in the book that I want you to speak to. The first one is the incident at the Spokane restaurant. that turned into a lawsuit. Karen, why don't you explain to us what happened there?
Well, she was on tour, and they were in the middle of a snowstorm. She was on a train with a friend and a personal assistant. They stopped at a diner, and they were refused service. And she said, well, there's no, you know, signs on the door saying, you know, colored only or white only or any of that. And she said, well, we're almost in Canada. So why is this happening in Washington State? And then it turned into, you know, a huge argument between her and the staff. And she filed a lawsuit after that, won the suit, and donated the money, the proceeds, to the NAACP.
Now, there's another example of this, Adam, involving a concert in Austin, Texas, that she walked out of because it was segregated and she had a rule about not performing before segregated audiences.
I do remember the incident because I remember her saying that the promoters in Texas had claimed that the audience wasn't really segregated because, after all, everybody was sitting on the same level in the orchestra. And she said, yes, but there was a big red carpet down the middle. And funny thing, everybody on one side of the carpet was white and everybody on the other side of the carpet was black.
Your father did not want you to know that she had been removed from this concert venue.
She wanted Adam to know. She said, well, I think that he should know that his mother was carried out of town by the sheriffs. And I think that Adam Jr., you know, his father, sort of wanted to protect him from that. But she was adamant about him knowing, and perhaps that was her way of letting him know just what kinds of sacrifices she was making, you know, or her efforts in civil rights and her efforts as an artist to fight against injustice. And she even said in one of her late interviews before she passed, she said, I didn't necessarily want to be labeled an activist. I just was doing what was right. I was doing what was necessary at the time.
Let me ask you, as we bring this to a close, I appreciate both of you. It's fascinating material. Adam, to talk about your mother from this standpoint, how do you want her to be seen? Here's a person who spoke seven languages. She was a Juilliard-trained pianist. She wrote poetry. She was a beautiful woman. She was a vocalist. She was married to one of the most powerful black politicians in America at the time, and she's your mom.
What I remember that's perhaps most unusual, looking back, it's extraordinary, is that every Saturday, almost without fail, she would be home. And we'd spend all day Saturday playing touch football, or if it was raining, going to a movie. There was one time I remember she and my father and I went to the movie theater around the corner, and it was a double feature of some, you know, Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman and Giant. Now that's a double feature. And they were, and we went to the movies, and they'd been up all night, and they had ice bags.
That's funny. Thank you both for coming in and sharing with us the story of Hazel Scott. It's a wonderful story, and people ought to know about her.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you. That was Karen Chilton. She is the author of Hazel Scott, The Pioneering Journey of a Jazz Pianist from Cafe Society to Hollywood to the House Un-American Activities Committee. She joined us from our NPR studios in New York. We also spoke to Hazel Scott's son, Adam Clayton Powell III. He joined me here at the studios of NPR West. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. When I think of love, what I first
think of is how for granted we take. That's music from Shantae Moore's Love the Woman. It's her first solo CD in 8 years. She's been singing duets with her husband, Kenny Lattimore, and she's been focusing on gospel music. As Shantae will tell you, the church is in her blood. And that's the first thing NPR's Tony Cox asked her. How does she straddle the two worlds, religious and secular?
Because it's not two worlds to me, I don't even think about it like that. Keeping my integrity is what I think about it. You just do your job and you do it well and you keep your integrity. And I don't sing anything I wouldn't be able to sing in front of my children. I don't sing anything I wouldn't be able to sing in front of my pastor. People fall in love whether you're, you know, at the church or if you're in the club. You do fall in love the same way, the feelings, emotions, the things that it brings from the inside of who you are, it's the same. And I want to be sure that I sing about love and not sex.
Well, let me talk about that with you for a moment, because mm-hmm. that's a really fine line, isn't it?
It is, in that I think people blur the lines of what's okay to say. I believe the line is very clear.
Really?
It's very clear.
Even in your CD, this new one that you have, which mm-hmm. is Love the Woman, and the photograph of you on the cover, which is, you know, very lovely, but it suggests to me, and I'm not a Bible thumping person at all, but mm-hmm. it would suggest to me that there are some churches in America where that picture of you on the cover would yeah. be trouble.
Well, I wouldn't wear that to church. That is true. But that really is the bigger struggle for me than anything, is what I wear.
Really?
Absolutely. What I sing is easy.
Why is that?
You can sing about love all day long, have a really pretty voice, and have a sexy, quote-unquote sexy voice, but not sing about sex and still emote those kind of feelings. But if you don't get to see something, it's different. I don't know what it is exactly, but I've been more pressured to wear sexy things than I have to sing about sexy things.
You comfortable with this?
I am. I'm sure some people aren't, but that's the other thing I have to know, is what is okay for me. Because there are some people who cannot sing R&B music because the Lord told them not to. I know that God put me in this place to stand for Him in this arena.
Do you feel what I feel when you kiss?
In listening to this, and I've listened to it several times, let me put it this way. When you listen to the whole thing, mm-hmm. how does it feel to you?
Well, it's one of my favorite things to do, is to listen to my record before it comes out. That's the first thing. Because it's before the judgment calls have come. And I tell you, I enjoy listening to this record so much. And probably because of being away from being a solo artist for a little bit, I think that had something to do with it. But I really like it a lot.
Do you remember the last time we shared a laugh? It seems like forever, 'cause now I hardly ever see a smile. I've never been the fool to think that love don't cost a little pain. I don't think it's supposed to be this hard to get along.
It Ain't Supposed to Be This Way is the song that is the one you hear when you click on your website. Is that because that's the one you guys want to push?
I felt like it was a good balance of the R&B and the jazz connection between both sides. Because I think if we went with First Kiss, which I absolutely love too, it would have lended more to the jazz side of the album. And the R&B crowd might not have come to it with the awareness that it's more R&B stuff on there also.
It seems like forever, 'cause now I hardly ever feel your touch. I've never been a fool to think love don't cost a little pain.
But I think it's supposed to be.
Your voice has been compared to a number of others because of your multiple octave range. Mm-hmm. Minnie Riperton for one, Niecy Williams for another, mm-hmm. and I know that you've done covers of both of their songs. But there is another sound that you have that I actually didn't know you had. Nancy Wilson. Guess who I saw today, my dear?
Guess who I saw today, my dear?
It was a challenge because it's Nancy, but because of what it means to do a Nancy Wilson song.
Yeah. Pressure.
Yeah, that's pressure. And actually, I had the best compliment. She heard the song and she came to me and told me how much she really, really liked it. And she was just smiling. She was like, I mean, you nailed it, baby.
Don't say a word. Don't say a word. Boy, don't try denying what fate has shown me to.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about Shantae Moore a little more personally, if that's okay with you. Because I read a quote of yours, and I want to read it to you and see what you see what you meant by it.
Okay.
Here it is. I think that's what I was put here to do, talk about my own life and my own views. I like to be able to expose my experiences so that people know they are not alone.
Yes.
Do you remember saying that?
Absolutely.
What do you mean?
Well, I've been through a lot. People don't like talking about things that hurt. Usually we like to skip over that stuff because it brings up something that's unpleasant. But honestly, it's the only way that I feel like some of those things have purpose because of somebody else's journey. And I really believe, you know, the quote from the scriptures that says, all things work together for my good. All things work together for my good, not just the stuff I liked, not just the stuff that felt really great and the highs in my life that were wonderful. Even not selling records has worked for my good because my ego is not in a place where you can't be in the same room with me and fit. I'm not in the place that when I see an unwed mother at 17 that I go, she probably didn't have no mama that cared about her. I had a mama that cared and I could have been that girl. And because of knowing that it could have been me, when I see them, the empathy in my heart is different than somebody else's who doesn't know what it's like to be that girl who's been manipulated and her innocence stolen from her. It was stolen from me. And I know what that feels like. And you feel by yourself. You feel damaged goods.
Your innocence was stolen from you?
Stolen. Yeah. And it happens to so many women, black, white, yellow, orange, green, whatever it is. We've all been in places where we've been victimized in some kind of way, usually.
Out of respect, I don't want to go there. Out of curiosity, I do. How much are you willing to tell us about how your innocence was stolen from you?
Well, growing up in a Christian family, you would have thought what happened to me would never happen because my mother loved me and she was very much aware of who I am. But I was a very mature little girl. And at 14, I was allowed to have a crush on a man who was 21. And because he was worldly and had money and he'd been in the Navy, you know, and I was like all little girls see older men and we go, oh, my God, he's so cute. Oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Well, somehow in there, my father wasn't watching. My mother was watching very closely and thought she could handle the situation. And she allowed this relationship to happen. It should not have happened. I should not have been allowed to date a man. It made me have insecurities at an early age that I should never have had. But a man who could manipulate a little girl's mind and her heart, he was allowed to do things he shouldn't have done.
You have daughters?
I have one daughter.
That will not happen to her.
She will not be allowed to do that. She can have the crush because you can't stop a heart from beating. You can't stop them from going, oh, my God, I love him. That's beautiful. But no man's going to walk up in my house and steal my baby. It's not going to happen.
I appreciate the time, and I appreciate your sharing that story with us. Well, I probably shouldn't say welcome back because that sounds like you've been away and gone.
I haven't been away.
You know, but welcome.
Thank you.
With this.
Thank you.
And then I feel like
NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Shantae Moore. Moore's new CD is called Love the Woman, and if you want to see the woman and get more of Tony's interview, we videotaped it. Just go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org. You can also find out what happened when P. Diddy laid claim to a song Shantae recorded, and then a similar version of that same song was written for Jennifer Lopez.
I heard that it was because Puff Daddy walked in and heard my song and said, I want that song. And he was like, yeah, well, that's already taken. You know, we wrote that for Shantae. And he was like, yeah, I want that song.
That's News and Notes. Nicole Childers, Christabel and Ciabuati, and Jeffrey Bennett produced the show. Sasha Woodruff edits, and Kenya Young is our director. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Donald Spaulding is our drive engineer. Our staff includes Tony Cox, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Gardner, Devin Robbins, and Zachary Slobig. Our interns are Blake Bishton and Ashley Lisney. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. On Monday, we talked to the mother of mega producer Dr. Dre about her new memoir, Long Road Outta Compton. I'm Farai Chidea. This is News and Notes.